what's the time?
It's time to get ill.
And what's the time?
It's time to get ill.
So what's the time?
It's time to get ill.
Now what's the time?
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Illiteracy Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Benson, a senior policy analyst at the Heartland Institute, a national free market think tank. And this is episode 130-something of the podcast. Sorry for never remembering what episode number it is, a bad habit. Point being, not a new podcast anymore. But for those of you just tuning in for the first time, basically what we do here on the podcast is I invite an author on to discuss a book of theirs that's been newly published or recently published on something or someone or some idea or some event that we think you guys would like to hear a conversation about. And then hopefully, at the end of the podcast or even in the middle of the podcast, if you get your druthers about you, you go ahead and purchase the book yourself and give it a read. So if you like this podcast, please consider giving Illiteracy a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. And also by sharing with your friends, as that's the best way to support programming like this. And my guest today is Miss Lori Weiner. And Ms. Weiner is a longtime critic and journalist who has been on staff at the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and was chief theater critic at the Los Angeles Times. She is also a founding editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books, and she is here to discuss her new book, or not quite new anymore, newish book, Oscar Hammerstein II and the Invention of the Musical, which was published last January by Yale University Press. So, Ms. Weiner, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Okay, so what made you want to? Well, actually, first, before we get to the book itself, you write in it that it's sort of obvious when you read it that you're a fanatic for musicals, for Broadway. Obviously, I'm assuming you had to start in childhood, because most things we're sort of fanatical about sort of start there. So how did you become such a lover of musicals, of the American theater, Broadway, all that stuff?
Well, I remember one of the first movies that my parents took me to was Mary Poppins, which came out when I was about 4 or 5. And we were sitting in the theater and it was just like, oh, this exists. I want this world. This is amazing. And I told my parents that I was going to sit through the movie again. And if they needed to leave, that was okay. And come back and get me, that would be okay. But I could not leave. It was just like this world is more intense, more vibrant, funnier, more electric, more alive than anything I've ever experienced. And I loved it. And then after that, they started to take me to the theater. Now, I lived in Baltimore, so it wasn't like primo theater, but I didn't know that. But we started going to musicals and, it was just, I have to have this in my life. This is unbelievable. I've never seen anything like this. And I still kind of feel that way.
Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned Mary Poppins. My son, who he's turning 4 in a few weeks, but maybe about a year or so ago, first put on Mary Poppins for him. And he, just absolutely adored it. I mean, the scene where they're in the painting and Bert is dancing with the penguins. I mean, I have videos of him just standing in front of the TV and just copying, Dick Van Dyke and, trying to do the little moves and just hopping about. And it's sort of wild. And he's seen The Sound of Music. He's seen, I'm trying to think what other musicals. Not so much a musical, but he's seen like The Nightmare Before Christmas and all that. And he sort of loves, and he likes all those Disney, even the new ones like Moana and sort of things like that. So it's interesting how they connect with children. But, the point you made, if, you just basically wanted to be in that world, I've seen t-shirts and or just like slogans. I don't know if you've ever seen this online, like, I don't know if life is a tragedy or a comedy, but thank God it's not a musical. And it's like, wait, like, why the hell would you not want life to be a musical? That would be fucking amazing. Excuse me. It would be incredible. Like, if I could just like go outside and just start breaking the song and like leading people down the street, and you know, like, who wouldn't like want to live in that world? Or you know, you just like
be a better world,
right? Or you just like you leave the, you know, the coffee shop or something, and you just like run into somebody else's, you know, musical, or you know, I mean, that would be great. But
sign me up.
Yeah, exactly.
Unlike most things that we love in childhood, the musical actually, the great musicals actually stand up to adult scrutiny.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
And that's another thing. You know, I didn't expect that. I mean, I didn't expect anything, but you know, to learn, you know, as one ages, that this stuff is not only still relevant, but more relevant, more meaningful. You know, it was a fantastic thing. It's like I've been a friend through my life that's offered me the best advice about living that I could imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, I was fortunate. I grew up in a household with a mother who was, I don't know if she's quite on your level of musical fanaticism, but pretty close. Like, just a big fan of Broadway and the theater and all the old MGM musicals, and you know, that she would watch repeatedly when I was a kid, and you know, that I'd seen. And we would go, I grew up in Bradley Beach, New Jersey, which is Monmouth County, so you know, about a 40-minute train ride out of Manhattan. And my dad worked in the city, and so we would go when I was a kid, and you know, Mom and I would take the train in the city, and we'd go meet my dad and have dinner at Sardi's and, you know, all that stuff. And then, and then go to the theater afterwards. So, I mean, probably since I've been about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years old, something like that, she was dragging me to the theater. I think like the first thing she took me to was La Cage aux Folles.
Oh, that's pretty fun.
Yeah. 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 And then
Sparkles, I guess, for a kid, for a little kid.
Yeah. Yeah. So I remember, we went out to visit my great grandmother out in Illinois, and apparently I vaguely remember this, but I guess we had a tape of the original cast recording, and we had to like listen to it the entire, like, you know, 10, 12 hours all the way out to Illinois.
Excruciating for you.
No, it was great. So I've always enjoyed it. I'm not like I'm nowhere near like my mom's level. I mean, I really enjoy the theater. The Great American Songbook, all those things. I mean, I'm a rock and roll kid,
yeah,
you know, for the most part. And a lot of that stuff I really didn't appreciate as much until I got a little older and smarter. But put it this way, for a 40-year-old straight dude, I've probably seen more theater than 99% of, you know, the rest of my cohort, for sure. So it's like,
the gene is now in your son, which is,
it's just like, it's always was something that was sort of ever present in my household. Just, so I've always enjoyed it. And that's what, led me to your book, because I realized I didn't really know much, you know, other than just sort of the basics of Oscar Hammerstein's story.
Right. That's so perfect. You're the perfect reader then.
Exactly. So, so to the book itself and to that idea, so what made you want to write this book? What was the genesis of it? And you wrote in here, you actually had a sort of a completely different idea for the book at first, correct?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been a journalist all my life, and I had never written a book. I mean, my husband has written like, you know, I don't even know, I have lost count of how many. And, you know, all of our friends are writers. We started the LA Review of Books together. You know, Los Angeles really does have an amazing kind of community of literary people, and everybody kind of congregated around the LA Review of Books. Anyway, I was one of the few people I knew who hadn't written a book. And I thought, you know, what is the most important, you know, what do I want to delve into? What is the most important thing to me? And it was, the answer was clear, this thing that has kind of guided me my whole life and that I feel is, you know, so rich in wisdom. And so I was going to do the 10 great American musicals and kind of what was great about them and what they said about America in the 20th century, which was the American century. And, but as I looked at the list of musicals I was considering, I realized that Oscar Hammerstein was the backbone of what I was so attracted to and wanted to delve into. And so I went to the Library of Congress and I met this amazing librarian, Mark Horowitz, and a music specialist, and just started going through Hammerstein's papers because I wanted to understand what made him the way he was. I started to realize that his personality, more than any other single person, was imprinted on the form of the musical, his sense of humor, his sense of ethics, how he looked at the world, his generosity, his hatred of bitterness, all of these things that I felt were so wise and in fact can really be found in all the great philosophers. But in the musical, the thought is so beautifully kind of compressed that you get, a century's worth of philosophy in a musical, and it's much mm-hmm. more pleasurable to take in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sort of with you. I put it this way, like if aliens came down and abducted you and were like asking you questions about just different things on Earth, and they were like, well, tell us about what is Broadway, what is, you know, what is the American musical? I mean, you would basically just go right to, I mean, I think this is true for most people. You would just go right to, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein and Oklahoma or, you know, something like that. I think like that would just be, if, you know, if you had to explain it to an extraterrestrial, you know, it, just bring it to its essence. That is the essence, is Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's right. Yeah. Especially if you're talking about, you know, America, I think, and American values, which, you know, those musicals, the five really successful ones were, you know, performed and still are performed all over the world. So it, you know, there's a global universal appeal as well. But I think that what they were thinking about and writing about was their country and what their country, you know, afforded them, gave them and stood for.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Now, Hammerstein, at his death, his critical reputation had sort of taken, I mean, he died in 1960,
August.
His critical reputation had taken sort of a hit. There was a turn away from what those musicals represented and what he represented. And I think you brought this up. It is, his career coincided with the birth of the cool or something like that, with the mile. I like that Miles Davis reference. Thank you.
Right. Yes. Miles Davis supported a lot of Richard Rodgers' melodies, by the way. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yes. Right. That's true. No. And so could you just talk a little bit about how his critical reputation took sort of a hit from that?
Yeah, I mean, as you said, it was kind of the cool kids in the critical community, which were in, you know, in the 60s when the Sound of Music movie came out. Oscar was already dead, but but even when the stage musical debuted in 59, you know, the cool people were, you know, the Beats, and it was a new aesthetic, and what Rodgers and Hammerstein had done was certainly no one could see, you could no longer see how innovative a show like Carousel or Oklahoma was, because that Carousel in Oklahoma had become the norm, had become the musical. So it didn't seem groundbreaking. You had to understand historically what came before them to understand why they were groundbreaking. It wasn't just readily apparent. But also they were at the end of, well, Oscar was at the end of his life. They were at the end of their collaboration. And they were not innovating as much as they had been. And even though The Sound of Music does have wonderful, wonderful things in it, and especially the stage version, in my opinion, because I think the movie musical took out some of the most interesting things in the musical, because the director, Robert Wise, wanted to focus on Julie Andrews and the children, understandable. But Julie Andrews and the children and the nuns were exactly the things that the cool kids were finding just too abundantly sentimental. And, so they were already starting to turn their nose up at the aesthetic. Of course, it was tremendously successful. I mean, I think the movie was one of the most successful movie musicals of all time.
I think the soundtrack recording for the movie was like the highest like selling album up until Tapestry by Carole King or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. Yeah. And then so when you run up to into Carole King in the early 70s, you know, it's just the folk aesthetic. It's just, it's a different sound. And also I think different values started to be favored by the majority of the population. And I think that Oscar and Hammerstein's belief in community and how we're all kind of the same underneath and we all have the same needs for human dignity and freedom, et cetera, was giving way to a new kind of search for meaning, exemplified by the new generation of songwriters, also by Hammerstein's protege, Stephen Sondheim. It was more about a search for individual meaning. Who am I? What is within me? And not so much a community-centric view of values. It was a shift away.
I was thinking about that, you know, after I read the book, and part of it, I think part of the reason too, is something I've actually thought a lot about. I don't know why, but something you talked about cool and sort of the birth of cool as a thing, which it, I mean, wasn't, you know, up, wasn't a, you know, there was no such thing as like cool before, you know, World War II. And it seems to me that cool has really seemed to kill off earnestness. You know what I mean? Like you don't want to look too earnest or just, you know, just excited about things or into the things that you're into, because that's not
very uncool.
It's totally uncool, you know, to care, right? So clearly, Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, the sentimentality, which I'm totally fine with, and it just didn't jive with cool, you know, I know it's not a Hammerstein song, but I mean, Richard Rodgers from The Sound of Music, just like, I've got confidence in me.
Oh, that's right.
That's like the most uncool song in like the history of the world. Right. But it's still good. You know, I don't know. So I have this theory about how you really see, I mean, like if you just like watch the movies in like the 40s and like the, you know, in the 50s still, and even still into the 60s somewhat, you know, it's the G Willikers and all that sort of, which we would now think kind of corny.
Yeah.
All that like cornball and earnestness and sentimentality, a lot of that has just sort of completely disappeared from visual arts in, you know, in a way. Maybe
that's produced some part of our current unhappiness.
I think so. I really do.
Oscar wrote to his daughter, Alice, in the 50s, about some bad habits she was acquiring from her mother, who was his first wife. And you know, his advice to her was, don't go on and on about like what you don't like. You know, it's boring. No one cares. If you really do love something, share that enthusiasm. People loved to hear that, you know, and I do think that's true. Like when I see people tweeting about how they hated, you know, this movie or that movie, it doesn't produce a cohesive communal response, you know, but people tweeting about something that they adored is just a better way to build a community.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, and you think about it, when we actually see someone being earnest, and it's so rare these days that it's how refreshing it is. Like, I think of like Steve Irwin, the Crocodile Hunter, you know what I mean? Like everyone loved that guy.
Right.
And, the Roberto Benigni, remember when he won the Oscars and he was like standing up on the chair and everything, you know, whatever you thought of that movie, it was sort of, refreshing just to see somebody, just so caught up in emotion like that with like happiness and joy. And it's not something we, like I said, we just see a lot of anymore because it's just, you know,
now at the Oscars, you see people, you know, hitting each other. So sorry.
Yeah, that's true, right?
Yeah.
Now they just commit assault on people. yeah. Anyway, that's a good point. So let's actually, before we get, let's talk about him a little bit as a person first, before we get into the more of the musicals. Let's start with his childhood and his family. So if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what his childhood was like, you know, sort of how he grew up. He had his grandfather, his sort of his famous, larger than life, namesake that he has that, is extremely important, figure in the world of American musical theater, but no one seems to, I mean, he's been completely overshadowed by his grandson and just sort of forgotten by time.
He has been. I mean, he tended to produce opera. That was his love. in the history of opera, you know, he's important. And also in the history of theater building, he's extremely important. He was building the first theater in Times Square when Oscar II was born in July 1895, sorry. So his grandfather was this major figure, also a huge narcissist. And his sons, that would be Oscar's father and Uncle Arthur, worked for the grandfather, Oscar I, and he didn't really care about anyone or anything but himself, but he was also extremely charismatic. He got things done. So, you know, he was a huge figure in the family and in American culture, yes, at the beginning of the 20th century. Oscar didn't really know him, didn't really know his grandfather that much. His grandfather was too busy to, you know, be concerned with the grandchildren. But he did go to see his grandfather as he was dying in the hospital. And he felt something spiritual in the room, as one does at those moments. But in this case, it maybe had even a patina of something more, because maybe greatness was, you know, being passed from one generation to the next generation. So Oscar II grew up in a family that was steeped in theater. His grandfather produced opera, but his father produced vaudeville and was producing the most popular vaudeville theater of the time, the Victoria. And so Oscar came of age in vaudeville in the 1920s, where there was a cultural mashup of all of the immigrants from Europe. Like 15 million immigrants came from Europe, you know, in between 1915 and 1920. And they all kind of met and talked about their differences and their cultures in vaudeville. It was just filled with ethnic acts. and every act had a title that you could not use today. You know, like, you know, I don't know, you know, Two Real Coons was Burt Williams' act. Burt Williams was considered to be the funniest man alive.
Or like Fintan O'Toole, the, you know, hard fighting Fenian, you know, something like, you know what I mean? Like,
it's just like every, you know, chinks, Jews, you know, all these words were in the titles of the acts. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, you know, excluding African Americans, for the most part, people were celebrating the differences, laughing about them. And it was just a raucous kind of free-for-all of nationalities. And that's what Oscar came of age in. And then he came to represent a kind of what we used to call liberal viewpoint in the 20th century about inclusiveness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, vaudeville, the prominence, I mean, it was basically the dominant sort of
popular culture.
The dominant medium for entertainment in popular culture in America in that period.
Definitely.
Yeah. So.
Oh, and the other thing about his childhood is that, you know, reading, trying to understand who he was, how he came to be the person he was, you know, the childhood he was loved, protected, you know, to the point where that could have produced, you know, a lazy, indolent child. He had a fantastic work ethic since he was very young, but that kind of just safety and being loved and appreciated, and his mother thought he was the greatest thing. His grandmother thought he was the greatest thing. They thought he was, you know, an old soul reborn in a, you know, baby's body. He seemed so wise as a youngster, and so he had a lot of nurturing that helped produce his confidence. And then what prevented him from overconfidence, arrogance, was his own innate humility, and also what he saw about how his grandfather's narcissism affected the whole family, and he did not want to be narcissistic, and he really wasn't.
Yeah, and they had to, because of his grandfather or because of his father, who gets sort of involved in the family business, they had to move. Incredibly.
They didn't necessarily have to move. They did move. They moved all the time, but a lot of families did in the 1920s in New York. It was just not unusual to pick up and move to another apartment building. So many apartment buildings were going up. The city was changing so quickly, and people were moving all the time.
Yeah, it's not like now where you just
never move.
Yeah, you never move ever until they pull your body out of the
right
out of the door. You're there.
Yes.
So he grows up in this theater milieu that's sort of, he's not a big fan of opera. He likes the music, but he's not really fond. I guess he's probably like most of us, you know, you do with that, like all the story and the sort of comical acting behind it. But so he's really going to be the one that's going to lead to this revolution in musical theater, where the book, the lyrics, the song, I mean, everything is sort of going to, everything advances the plot. It's all sort of, I guess, integrated is the word that's used. And he's going to do this with a collaborator. I don't know if many people even realize that he wrote with, and that's Jerome Kern, who is already a fairly established songwriter in his own work, by the time they start collaborating. And then they get to Showboat, which just completely, changes the face of the American musical. It's a completely revolutionary piece of American art.
It is. It definitely is, although it's difficult to produce today. As I say in the book, you know, a lot of the artists who dared to write about other cultures, other races, because they actually cared about the the world and other people are now on the firing line today because they don't have the exact level of enlightenment that we have today.
We think we have today.
Well, we think we have today. Yeah. Absolutely. So a lot of times the baby is thrown out with the bathwater in this kind of mania for political correctness. I think it's a mistake to throw out our culture and our history like that.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, sorry. Did you want to keep going or?
No.
Okay. No. Yeah. I've never seen Showboat performed. It's one of the, I've seen pretty much all of the, at least all the Rodgers and Hammerstein, in revival or at some point. I've never seen Showboat. The only thing I think I've ever, I remember I was on like a road trip and I was just like flipping through, like AM channels, and it just happened to be coming on like whatever the local like NPR station was. And I don't know if it was a revival I'm assuming it was from a revival on Broadway. And so I just listened to it in the car, and that's the only time I've ever actually heard it performed beginning to end. I mean, I've heard Old Man River 8 billion times and, Can't Help Loving That Man and all that stuff. But
what did you think about it when you heard it on the radio? What was your reaction?
Well, first I was just, I wasn't sure if, because you never know. I mean, you brought this up, what changes have been made to language and the content. And obviously you can't see it. So you don't know what's going on the stage that everyone's performing. So my first thought was like, well, I wonder how much of this is different from, the actual version. And they did censor or change out the one word the play begins with.
That's right.
Which you can imagine. But no, it was great. And, like I said, I'd already been familiar with, half of the songs in that show anyway. Yeah. So, but to hear it like actually in the context of the show itself, was new and is interesting. And, but you think of a song like Old Man River, I'm sort of rambling here.
No.
It's hard for me to think of, I mean, obviously there was a time when that song didn't exist, but it's hard to, that song just seems sort of timeless, and just like it's hard to imagine it not existing. I think Bob Dylan, I think he said it about Van Morrison, and I forget, Tupelo Honey maybe. Yeah. He said something that like Tupelo Honey had always existed, just Van Morrison was the vessel and the earthly vehicle to like bring it into,
I love that theory of and Oscar had it too, of the artist being a vehicle for something that's
a conduit, right? Yeah.
Him. Like with a singer, that's easy to understand, but with a writer, that when things are really working, writers feel like they're in touch with some larger entity. And I find that very, very moving and compelling. And Oscar, in a letter to, to Otto Harbach, who was a fellow lyricist that he wrote with when he was much younger, he recalled they were having a big struggle in one of their shows. I think it was the song, Indian Love Song. Anyway, in the 20s, they're having a struggle finding the right song. And Oscar Harbach said to Oscar Hammerstein, this song exists. It's there. We just have to find it. And Hammerstein was recalling that moment in a letter to Otto on his 80th birthday. And I find that just peculiarly moving and stimulating
Yeah, I just would say, but you hear it like something like that, you hear it enough from so many different people, right? Like songwriters, where they're like, the pen was just pulling itself, and right, it just pour it out, you know, like, yeah, I mean, but like, exactly. Like it comes from so many different people from so many different walks of life and just through different generations and everything that like, you know, it's probably the romantic in me, but there has to be something, you know, something behind it, you know.
You'd think, although you have to also consider the opposite, which is, you know, a terrible writer who's writing unique bullshit might.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Feel that too, you know.
It could be like, yeah, the pen just pulled itself, and I just wrote all this turgid shit. Right. You know, that's a good point. I never thought of it that way.
I don't know.
yeah, but so at the time was when Showboat came out. I know it was a big success. I think you mentioned in the book that the first showing on Broadway that the audience was for a good 5-10 seconds didn't even react at all, and I forget who it was. It was like, oh crap, they hated it, and then just sort of instantaneously bursted out into this rapturous ovation. But
well, can I just correct that story a little?
Oh sure, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I'm paraphrasing.
It wasn't the Broadway opening. It was
it was
the Washington D.C. pre-Broadway opening. So it was actually in 26, not 27, when Showboat opened on Broadway. And Ziegfeld, the producer, who had never produced a serious show before with a story and was fighting Hammerstein all throughout.
This is Ziegfeld of Ziegfeld's Follies.
Right, Florence Ziegfeld, who was kept telling Hammerstein, it's too serious, you know, it's too long. It was too long, it was way too long. But it's too serious. You got to take out the seriousness. And Oscar was still quite young. You know, in 26, he would have been 31. Anyway, it wasn't the end of the show. It was the intermission. Because by the end of the show, the audience was so exhausted that it could barely clap at all. Because it was 4.5 hours long at that point. But it was at the intermission when they were shot. They were seeing something really brand new that they had not seen before, and they were just kind of shocked. So they didn't respond for, you know, it wasn't 5 minutes, but you know how 15, 20 seconds can feel like 5 minutes in the theater. And Ziegfeld was sure that he had been right and this was a flop and everyone hated it in that silence. And then everybody cheered. But they were stunned is really the point.
But was it considered at the time as revolutionary? I mean, was it sort of paint like obvious on its face that this is a completely different way from what we've been doing things? Like there's that scene in Singing in the Rain where they interrupt, you know, the head of the studio comes in, interrupts the making of the Dueling Cavalier or whatever it is and says, you know, we're shutting this down, you know, because of the jazz singer and you know what I mean? The jazz singer came out. And so now talkies are a thing. So now we have to completely redo everything that we're doing. Had that effect or?
No, because Showboat's innovations were much more like on a cellular, subtle level. Like the jazz singer, okay, this is a new thing. People are singing, you know, in film and we can hear them. This is, you know, you can't go backwards from this. Mm-hmm. But with Showboat, I think its effect was so subtle and so deep. It took a much longer time to kind of sink in. And one of the proofs I give of this is when Time Magazine did a cover story on Hammerstein in 46, the first thing they say, the lead is, you know, in the 1920s, you know, he wrote Showboat and Sweet Adelaide and Sunny, and they were all hits. Like with no kind of realization of how different Showboat was. It was just one of his hits in the 20s. So this is Time Magazine, which is like middle America in 46. It still was not necessarily recognized as the revolution that was, because I think revolutions take a long time to sink in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like I said, he has these hits in the 20s, especially Showboat, but then the 30s come along and there's sort of a, I guess you call it like a lost decade for him artistically. I mean, or it's a financial struggle. Nothing he seems to work on has any sort of success. How did, I mean, he tries to go into Hollywood and working on the pictures and, you know, as a sort of songwriter for hire and all this other stuff. And nothing seems to suit him. And it's just a, he has a reputation, he gets a reputation for failure. And, you know, people, by the end of the 1930s, the start of the 1940s, sort of Oscar Hammerstein is sort of synonymous with, you know, flop.
Has been, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely. Well, you know, right after the Depression, Hollywood kind of, they just hired every songwriter in New York. They all came to Hollywood because Hollywood thought they were going to do musicals and that was how they would lift people out of the Depression, you know, spiritually. And they did, you know, to some extent do that. I mean, with like the Rogers, you know, the Fred Astaire,
Ginger Rogers.
And... Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Astaire, Ginger Rogers musicals, with a lot of them with music by Jerome Kern, did do that. They were so ebullient and joyful that they really did help people forget their problems. But what was happening with Oscar, what he didn't realize it at the time, but his struggle, what he was trying to solve in his head, the problems, had to do with storytelling, and impeccable storytelling was not what Hollywood was concerned with in the 1930s. So every time you try,
not really now either, but
right. It's still pretty rare. But
yeah,
but that was his puzzle that he was trying to solve, and to try to solve it in Hollywood in the 1930s was just an impossible situation. He was, you know, in a sense, you know, fated to fail in that situation. Of course, he couldn't have realized it at the time. He didn't realize it. And he had such a strong work ethic. He kept working. He never stopped working, but he couldn't get his hands on anything that had traction. And that drove him crazy because in the 20s, he did have traction. You know, he was with the culture and mm-hmm. talking to the culture and part of the culture. And in the 30s, he just couldn't get that. With a few exceptions, he just couldn't get that traction, and then it wasn't until he returned to the theater with a new writing partner, Richard Rogers, which they started working together in 1942. You know, the war is, you know, overwhelmingly on everyone's mind.
Sure.
So anyway, he gets a grip on what he's been the problem that he's been trying to solve after he leaves Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. So how did he and Dick Rogers hook up? What was the, how did that come about?
Well,
that partnership?
You know, it was very, you know, small world, the New York theater world in the 1920s, which is when they met. I mean, they may even have met, I think it was 1919 when Oscar was doing a musical at Columbia University and Richard Rogers' older brother, Mort, was in Oscar's class, and Richard Rogers' older brother brought the 14-year-old Richard Rogers to see the musical at Columbia that Oscar Hammerstein was starring in. And this little, and so this boy, Richard Rogers, comes backstage and they have a moment and then they know each other. And then they continue to see each other all throughout this whole time in the 30s in Hollywood. So they're very much aware of each other and each other's work. But it's not until 1942 when Richard Rogers finally says goodbye to Lorenz Hart, his writing partner for all those years, who was, you know, a terrible alcoholic and very unreliable. And Richard Rogers kept trying to leave him, but couldn't quit him. Because he was so talented. But finally in 1942, he's just searching for a new writing partner. And that's when he suggests that the two of them get together. And Hammerstein knows right away it's a great idea. Richard Rogers had written, you know, aside from Jerome Kern, the most beautiful melodies that America had produced. So Hammerstein was ready and they knew each other and they knew each other's work. So in a way, their coming together was easy for them to come together because they had so much knowledge of each other in 1942.
So what is their writing process like, or their collaboration? How do they collaborate with each other? And how do Oscar's lyrics inform Dick's melodies and vice versa? How do they, how do they play off each other? Do they do, do they start with the music first and then with the lyrics, or, you know, is it hit or, I mean, does it depend, you know, sometimes it's lyrics, sometimes it's music, or how does
every song team does it differently. Rodgers and Hammerstein almost always started with the lyrics. So that meant that Oscar Hammerstein had a lot of control over the ideas they were putting forth. And Oscar Hammerstein was a much deeper thinker than Richard Rodgers. Richard Rodgers was unbelievably gifted, but as a thinker, he was not particularly gifted. If you read his, well, he didn't write that much, but his letters, even his interviews, you can see that he was really, just a kind of mediocre thinker. And Oscar Hammerstein was the one taking on the big ideas and bringing them to the collaboration. A lot of people prefer Richard Rodgers' music with Lorenz Hart, the first partner.
It's
very tough because they are amazing, great songs.
Oh yeah,
but they're not. I mean, so if he's responding to Hart's psyche for the first half of his career, and he's responding to Hammerstein's psyche in the second half of his career, Oscar's psyche was bigger. His ideas were larger, and consequently, the scores were larger, bigger, lusher, more romantic. He did respond to Oscar's ideas and to his sensibility with very lush scores and songs.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, so Oscar, once he comes back to the East Coast and comes back to theater, I'm not sure how, what exactly, I can't remember what year he moves there, but he buys a farm, basically Doylestown, Pennsylvania.
Right. I think in 40, I think they buy it in 40. Yeah.
1940, okay. So do you think these great collaborations he had with Rodgers, these, wonderful shows they put together, do you think that would have been possible if he hadn't moved to Doylestown? Because it seemed that there was something in that place that had a, moving there had an effect on, had some sort of power over him in some way. I mean, do you think that, he would have contributed what he did if, instead of living in Doylestown, they would have just had an apartment on Park Avenue and maybe a place on Long Island or something like that? Or,
well, it's hard to say because, when writers are really, really involved in their projects, it kind of doesn't matter where they are, right? Your physical environment kind of disappears. Mm-hmm. But I take your point. I think Oscar, who grew up in the city, New York City, always had a kind of a longing for the country, which he could feel from time to time when he was in it. And he did feel something spiritual at that farm, being in nature, walking around with the animals. And then, the first song that he writes with Richard Rodgers is "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning." And it's very much someone walking in nature, seeing the animals, acknowledging the aliveness of everything around him. And I think that Oscar did feel that at the farm. And that was why that was the first song that burst out of him when he wrote with Richard Rodgers. It's okay. Kind of a miraculous song also because it's so much about being grateful to the bounty of the universe and life itself. And he had just come off of this, 13-year dry period where he had been fighting the bitterness of his ex-wife and trying to get her to understand that bitterness will not help you, will not get you out of where you are. Mm-hmm. And then the first song he writes is this song about gratitude, which I think is very telling.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing up one of his wives. Let's just talk a little bit about his two wives, because I haven't read that much about musical theater and that much, but I have to imagine that they haven't received sort of the prominence that they do in this book. I mean, at least to at least with Dorothy, his second wife. And
well, I mean, no one has written about Myra Finn ever. I mean, it was the first one. It was really difficult to find, you know, her biographical stuff, her death date. I mean, she is not written about at all, but because of his letters to her in the 30s, she is a major part of my thesis about how he became the man that he became, because he was trying to articulate a way of being in the world for Myra, who tended to be jealous and petty. And if you want to see, you know, Myra's personality, you can look at the character of Jenny in Allegro, which is a very ungenerous portrait of her. But for a generous portrait of her, you can look at Ado Annie in Oklahoma, the girl who couldn't say no, because Myra indeed had affairs and had many affairs. Anyway, there's nothing on Myra in musical theater history at all. And then Dorothy is kind of this wonderful figure because she was also almost like a mother to Stephen Sondheim. So she does have a place in musical theater history and has been written about, but had a very delightful personality as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I knew that Hammerstein and Sondheim had a sort of like mentor-mentee relationship. I did not realize that how far back they went together. That Sondheim was basically bumming around his house, you know, when he was 12 years old or something. Like that. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that relationship between the two of them, Sondheim and
okay. So Sondheim's parents get divorced when he's 11, I think, and he loves his dad and he really does not get along with his mom. And his mom is a horrible, horrible narcissist. Is also extremely inappropriate with him when he's young, because she's suddenly left alone and she's lonely and she's with her brilliant 12-year-old son and she's crying on his shoulder and maybe sometimes sleeping in his bed. She's just a very inappropriate, narcissistic mother. She's a horrible mother. And he gets left with her. The father leaves and remarries, and he gets to stay with them sometimes.
I think you had a line in the book about like something she wrote to him that was basically like, the only thing I regret about my life is giving birth to you or something like that. Or
she writes that the night before she's going into surgery and she thinks she might die. So you get to say your last thing in on earth to your son. And you say, my only regret in life is that I gave
it birth. Explains so much about
Sondheim's wonderful relationship. But the funny thing is that the mom, whose name is known as Foxy, her name is Janet, was a social climber par excellence. And she moves very near the Hammersteins in Doylestown because she really wants to be friends with them because she's, you know, because they're famous. But that gives her son the opportunity to ride his bike over to the Hammersteins and really become part of their family. Mm-hmm. And the Hammersteins did not like the mother because no one really did, but they did not badmouth her to Stephen Sondheim when he was a boy, because they understood what their role was in that situation. Sure. So Stephen Sondheim implants himself at Doylestown exactly when Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein II are beginning to write together, when they're writing Oklahoma. So he implants himself in musical theater history.
So he's present for the creation, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's just some kind of, you couldn't write this. If this was a movie, you wouldn't believe it.
Sure. Now, speaking of Oklahoma, let's, we've already gone 55. Oh my God. All right. So we got to move along here because I don't want to keep you, you know, too much longer than I said I would. But let's talk about Oklahoma just because it's another, I guess the two revolutionary, truly revolutionary shows that, that Hammerstein's going to be a part of, the first being, you know, Showboat, and then this is Oklahoma. But Oklahoma, again, this is after they start, Rodgers and Hammerstein start working on Oklahoma, and this is after Hammerstein's sort of decade of failure. So this is sort of a do or die moment for him with this musical. There might, you know, if this doesn't, if Oklahoma flops, you know, there's no saying that Rodgers is going to choose to work with Hammerstein again or something like that. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about that. And then, you know, what makes Oklahoma such a revolutionary show?
Okay. Well, Oscar was, you know, he's often been called, and, you know, an optimist, he called himself that. And PBS did a documentary about him. And I think they, it's called like something, the optimism is in the title. He's very much associated with that quality. And he was a perennial optimist. And that was both his weakness and his strength. His weakness in that he couldn't read the tea leaves often when things were not going his way because he was too much of an optimist. But when he was writing with Richard Rodgers, his optimism was just spilling out of him. It had not been beaten down. And so I don't think he saw it. I never got the sense that he saw it as a do or die moment because he was so excited about it from the second they started working on it. So I didn't get a do or die sense from him, okay. But his optimism coincided with a turning point in the war. That is, you know, 1943, when Oklahoma opened, I think it was March 31st, the war really had started to turn. Stalingrad had happened in January. It started to look like we were going to win this war. And so despite all the hardships, the deaths, and the privations that were going on in 43, people were beginning to feel, you know, a sense of the war was going to end. It was going to end in our favor. And what was the world going to be like then after we defeated the bad guys? So the enormous optimism of Oscar Hammerstein infected the musical, and it coincided with what was going on in the country at that very moment. And so the optimism about who we are and what we could be just infused everything on a gigantic level. And that was why you couldn't get a ticket. You know, it was a hit. It was very much like Hamilton in the first couple of years. Everybody wanted to have this ecstatic experience that they were sure the musical was going to give them, and you could not get a ticket, you know, unless you knew someone. Mm-hmm. It was just very similar.
I will admit this on air. I have not seen Hamilton yet. I haven't even watched the, I don't know why. I think I do know exactly why. Cause I remember when Hamilton was like first coming out before it just like exploded, and I was reading, someone had written a review of it, and they made, I don't know if they just didn't know better or what, but like they made Lin-Manuel Miranda sound like he was just like some Puerto Rican street kid who had like just read Ron Chernow's biography of Alexander Hamilton, and then out popped this rap musical. And I was like, oh, that's really incredible. And then I started reading about like Lin-Manuel Miranda. I was like, oh wait, he's just another theater kid. So I mean, it's not as like completely, you know, out of the blue sui generis as I thought. And for some reason, that's always just like
that you resented that.
Yeah, it's like it sort of burst my bubble. And then
he was teaching high school. I mean, he was not, you know,
I mean, like he wasn't successful, yeah. But like they made it seem like he was completely divorced from like mm-hmm. musical theater entirely. Like he'd like never had any sort of concept of that whatsoever. And just like, he he read the book and then just outflowed this, you know, this rap musical. And then, so I got really excited about it. Then I found out that that's not true. He actually went to like a, you know, school for the arts and all that stuff. And I was like, oh, wait, all right. So that's not as special as I thought.
But let me ask you this. Do you think that's a good reason for not seeing it?
No, no, it's just, no.
I'm sorry to be like,
no, of course not. Well, by then, I think it exploded into that sort of cultural phenomenon that it became. I think when I read it at the time, it was just like the talk of sort of New York and the, you know, sort of the theater world before it had, you know, just, I think the other thing too that made me resent it was like, Hamilton was always like my dude, my guy of the founding fathers. Yeah. Like I always loved Hamilton because, I mean, he was like, I mean, I grew up in Jersey, so he was like the one like main founding father that had like the most, you know, like Boston had their guys, you know, like Sam Adams and John Adams and all that. And Philly had Ben Franklin, and Virginia had, you know, Washington and Jefferson and Madison. And like we had Hamilton. And I remember, you know, just going to, you know, visit my dad, walking past his grave at Trinity Church and all that stuff, and just knowing all that. And so, and then everybody became like super into Hamilton. And I guess you could sort of relate it to like a guy who's a fan of a band, like an underground band. And then like that band becomes like gets on a major label and becomes like popular and has like a platinum record. And then that fan like hates the band for like resents it that like everybody now likes his favorite band, that sort of thing. I think partially that's what it is. But
I get that. I get that.
So, because now if people are like, oh, and I mean, I don't know who really has these conversations, but whether you're talking about your favorite founding fathers, but if you just like bring up Hamilton, like, oh, like the musical and all that, it's like, no, it's like, it has nothing to do with the musical. So, you know, that sort of thing. So I think that's really the genesis of my ambivalence towards Hamilton.
But you've heard some of the score, maybe? You've heard any of it?
Yeah, you know, Shoot Your Shot and all that. Yeah, I've heard parts of it. I haven't heard the whole thing, but I mean, I could, you know, I've heard. I'm trying to think. What are the? Can't remember the names of some of the other songs, but I'm aware of what you know, the most famous pieces of the score are for Hamilton. Anyway,
I do hope you see it. I do hope you see it.
I know. I mean, it's on Disney Plus. I can just, you know, I mean, I could watch it right after we record this.
You can watch it right now.
I could. Maybe I'll do that.
Put it on. I'll watch it with you. All
right. Yeah. I'll bring the computer downstairs and we can watch Hamilton together. No. All right. So we've already gone over an hour. Just a couple more things. It sucks that we're going to have to like not really talk about Carousel and King and I and South Pacific and all these things, but
well, maybe your listeners will demand a part two.
Okay. Yeah, maybe. But I want to get to, you had this critique of Rodgers and Hammerstein from John Marr in there. I think it said that quote, that Rodgers and Hammerstein engineered the musical equivalent of the interchangeable part, which ensured a sort of quality control. I'm assuming you disagree with that. I mean, I see there's a sort of a kernel of truth to that, but that seems like a very, at best, a backhand compliment. You know, it suggests artistic competency, but not greatness. You know, like or genius. You know, like obviously a Ford is not an Aston Martin or a Ferrari. You know what I mean? So. Do you think that's that is true to a degree, or do you think that's just?
I don't think that's true, and you have to look at where John Marr is coming from. Let me back up a second. Once you have created something that becomes the thing that everyone is copying, and it's true that, you know, the musical today is still in some ways harmed by people's adherence to what Rodgers and Hammerstein did because they're not innovating enough or whatever. But so it's just once it becomes the form, then of course people might repeat it or try to, you know, duplicate it. But where John Lorre is coming from with that statement is that his father was Bert Lorre, the cowardly lion in The Wizard of Oz. And the rest of that sentence, I believe, is that it killed the individual, idiosyncratic individual performer, which it didn't. But it's true that in vaudeville, where Bert Lorre came of age, the individual performer was, you know, like a god, and and once you built a well-built show, you couldn't have, you know, Zira Mostel was constantly ad-libbing in Fiddler on the Roof, and it drove the writers insane. You know, they hated that because it's a show that they wrote and they want to see it performed as they wrote it. Anyway, no, I don't. And another thing, John Lorre is a great writer and a really good thinker, but he also didn't get Sondheim at all. So,
right, but I mean,
great
critic. I see where he's getting at, because with Rodgers and Hammerstein, a musical, I mean, no matter who's in the cast, the star of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical is Rodgers and Hammerstein. It's not, you know, whoever it may be. You know, you go, you know, you don't, I mean, you go to see a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical to hear Rodgers and Hammerstein. You don't, I mean, you don't go to,
Although, you know, stars do. I mean, Hugh Jackman did Curly in Oklahoma. Fucking great. Oh, sorry.
No, that's fine. That's fine. We can have the occasional expletive.
So stars do, you know, do it.
No, sure. Absolutely. But I mean,
yes, they can't just do their thing. No.
Right.
Of course. They can't do that in a play either. I mean,
Right. All right. I think we should... probably talk about The Sound of Music a little bit, just for a few moments at least. Okay. Because again, just this is something I think probably pretty obvious that this is their sort of most cherished work, certainly mostly because of the movie itself.
Which was franchised by baby boomers like myself.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's like one of those things that like every kid, just probably since 1965, has, you know, grown up with that movie to some degree, if you were born in America since 1965. So it's massively successful. One of the most, the play itself, the movie is one of the highest grossing films ever made. Again, we talked about the soundtrack album and all that. But it's so beloved now, and it's just sort of part of, again, it's just sort of part of everyone's lives to some degree, that I don't think people would realize how much criticism it came in for when it was released. And was it right before he died? Was it 1959 or 19?
Well, the stage musical was 59. Yeah.
59. Right. Yeah. Yeah. But, a lot of critics were not too keen on Sound of Music.
Like we said, I mean, the people who considered themselves too cool for it, you know, were, you know, many, and a lot of them had jobs as critics. There were critics who loved it. But most people felt it was, you know, very sentimental.
Yeah.
Too sentimental. Yeah. And then the movie musical took out all of the sharp stuff.
And all the stuff about fascism.
Yeah, you were, not all the stuff about fascism, because there obviously are Nazis in the movie, but...
But the song sort of specifically about...
The really interesting song about how people tell themselves that they're not going to get involved to stop something clearly evil, because what can one person do? It's really a brilliant song, and I think it's very relevant today, but of course they took it out of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the last song, he writes, because Hammerstein gets cancer in the late 50s. He doesn't live very long after Sound of Music debuts on Broadway.
Right.
And then the last song he writes is Edelweiss, which again is just one of those songs that is sort of like Old Man River, like you sort of just can't imagine not existing. Like, I think I heard a story that when Gerry Ford was president, they had like a state visit from the Austrian, I don't want to say chancellor, if that sounds that sounds too Hitlerish, but whoever the president of Austria was. And when I guess they had the band play Edelweiss because they thought that was like the national anthem of Austria. And I was like, no, it was a song written 10 years ago by Oscar Hammerstein. Right. But it just seems like one of those things that's just been like, you know, just a timeless, like instantly timeless. I don't know if that sort of an
oxymoron. Yeah, but so well known that maybe people don't hear it anymore. Mm-hmm. Just a really quick story. At my book party in Los Angeles, I had a singer play and sing Edelweiss with a kind of a modern, more modern tilt toward it. But before she sang it, you know, I talked about Oscar and his, how this was the very last thing that he wrote. And it was a blessing. It was about his country. The last lyric that he wrote was "Bless my homeland forever." Mm-hmm. And when you listen to the song with a kind of new interpretation, you know, a new singer singing it with the knowledge of everything that Oscar had done before and that this was his last words, it's unbelievably moving. And everybody was absolutely crying and seized with a feeling of tenderness toward their country.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's incredible. All right. So one final, or maybe like two more questions, but like wrap up questions basically. Mm-hmm. So you write in the book that Oscar's vision can be or could be a touchstone for us today, something we can make use of. How so? What is Oscar's vision, and what do you mean by how it can be a touchstone for us?
You know, it's about humanity and how everyone is connected. And everyone, as I said at the beginning, kind of needs the same things in order to fulfill their destiny as a human being. And, you know, that is, you know, freedom, dignity, maybe that's it. So a little money. but it was the idea that we're all connected, which is such a resonant theme in the theater when everybody is sitting together. When I saw the South Pacific at Lincoln Center in the 2000s, I was just overwhelmed with this feeling of my parents and their generation and what this musical meant to them. And here we were sitting here, you know, being moved by the same exact stuff. The continuity of that is very moving in the theater. And things about community really resonate in the theater. Anyway, that's why he's more of a theater man than anything else. And it's why that the musicals play better on the stage than do on the screen. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's the big idea is that we're all alike and we need respect. We need to respect each other. It's not about our differences. You know, it's not about what makes us individuals and what defines us against other people. It's just about, it's about coming together. And I think that's the only hope for us, is for people to realize that we're all in this together. You know, the, mm-hmm. the air is polluted, you know, in Georgia, we're going to feel it in Los Angeles. I mean, it's just, anyway, I think it's a very beautiful conception of how we should live together. And I do think it is very much still relevant.
All right, great.
Without fashion.
All right, great. So last exit question. You might have just actually answered it with that last answer, but it's something I always ask everybody that comes on, sort of the last question, and that's basically what would you like the audience to get out of this book, or what's the one thing you'd want a reader to take away from the book having read it?
Well, I'd like them to feel that he was a great American and a great artist, because I do think he's often taken for granted and condescended about. But I also kind of want the theater world to keep doing his musicals. And because I think they're just incredibly valuable. So those are the two things.
I don't think I can imagine a world where they're not doing Rodgers and Hammerstein. I mean, I just think it's, I mean, you never know who might be, you know, sort of retroactively canceled for whatever reason. But
you never do know. Someone probably got canceled in the time we were talking here.
I know, right? Yeah, well, it might be Hamilton.
I don't think so.
Lin-Manuel Miranda. So then I'll be justified and not what? No. But anyway, but
you'll see. You'll see.
But yeah, I mean, like the Rodgers and Hammerstein, the shows and the songs especially are just sort of, I mean, they're just sort of part of the American lingua franca at this point, you know. It's just sort of like baked into the culture, it seems like. And like I said, I don't know, stranger things have happened, but I can't see it, but I'm with you. I hope that never happens.
Good. We are in agreement.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So won't keep you any longer. The book once again is Oscar Hammerstein II and the Invention. Oh, actually, yeah. One more question. Oscar Hammerstein II and the Invention of the Musical is the book from Yale University Press. Do you have, before we go, anything else you want to plug, anything you got going on or appearances or anything like that you want to put out there?
I moved to France and I'm writing a book about Hitler because I feel there aren't enough books about Hitler. No, but I really am. and I can't really, I just can't explain it, but all will be revealed in time.
All right. Book about Hitler. So ask about it. You won't find too many Hitler books out there. So
No. I've been searching.
I know it's amazing that it's been so unremarked upon.
He's like Myra Finn. It's like no.
Yeah. One. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Oh God. Anyway. Again. Yeah. The book is Oscar Hammerstein II and the Invention of the Musical. Highly, highly recommend this book.
Thank you.
It's fantastic. Even if you guys out there are not fans of musicals, which I'm sorry for you. I feel like your life is a much drearier place. I suggest that you try to reevaluate that and, give them a second chance and maybe read the book as well. And then from there, you can go on to, either watching the movies or attending a local performance at Rodgers and Hammerstein musical or Showboat or something. And but it's a fantastic book. There was a lot of things in here that I did not realize and went into the context behind the musicals themselves and the ideas behind them and thought it was really, really fantastic. So highly, highly recommend again for everybody. Oscar Hammerstein II and the Invention of the Musical and the author and my guest today, Miss Laurie Weiner. So Miss Weiner, thank you so much for coming on and doing the podcast.
Such a pleasure.
Thanks for staying a little late for me. Yeah. And and thank you lastly for taking the time to actually write the book and so that we all could enjoy the fruits of your labor. So thank you so much.
All right. It was great.
All right. Thank you. Thanks. And again, if you like this podcast, please consider leaving us a 5-star review and sharing with your friends. And if you have any questions or comments or there's any books out there you'd like to see us discuss on this podcast, you can reach out to me at tbenson@heartland.org. That's tbenson@heartland.org. And for more information about the Heartland Institute, you can just go to heartland.org. And you can also reach out to us at our Twitter account for the podcast. If you have any questions, comments, anything like that, feel free to, give us a follow, send us a DM, all that sort of stuff. Keep it clean though. What is our Twitter handle? Our Twitter handle is @illbooks @ILL books. So make sure you check that out. And that's pretty much it. So thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you guys next time. Take care. Love you, Robbie. Love you, Mon. Bye-bye.
When I take you out tonight with me, honey, here's the way it's gonna be. You will sit behind a team of snow-white horses in the slickest gig you ever see. Chicks and ducks and geese better scurry when I take you out in the Surrey. When I take you out in the Surrey with the fringe on top. Watch that fringe and see how it flutters when I drive them high-stepping strutters. Nosy pokes will peek through the shutters and their eyes will pop. The wheels are yellow, the upholstery's brown, the dashboard's genuine leather. With eyes and glass curtains you can roll right down in case there's a change in the weather. Two bright side lights winking and blinking, ain't no finer rig I'm a-thinking. You can keep your rig if you're thinking that I'd care to swap for that shiny little Surrey with the fringe on the top.
Would you say the fringe was made of silk?
Wouldn't have no other kind but silk.
Has it really got a team of snow-white horses?
One's like snow, the other's more like milk. All the world will fly in a flurry when I take you out in the Surrey. When I take you out in the Surrey with the fringe on top. When we hit that road hell for leather, cats and dogs will dance in the heather, birds and frogs will sing all together, and the toads will hop. The wind will whistle as we rattle along, the cows will moo in the clover, the river will ripple out a whispered song, and whisper it over and over. And never stop in that shiny little Surrey with the fringe on the top.
Stars getting blurry when we ride back home in the Surrey, riding slowly home in the Surrey with the fringe on top. I can feel the day getting older, feel a sleepy head near my shoulder, nodding, drooping close to my shoulder till it falls kerplop. The sun is swimming on the rim of a hill, the moon is taking a header, and just as I'm thinking all the earth is still, a lark will wake up. Hush, you bird, my baby's a-sleeping. Maybe got a dream worth a-keeping. Whoa, you team, and just keep a-creeping at a slow clip, clop. Don't you hurry with the